Okay. So we'll get to your calls for Tony Fells coming up in just a second. But I saw as the roster of phone callers coming up appeared on my screen on the first time caller line, I saw Dr. Anne Blake Tracy, or at least I think that's who that is. So let me grab her before we go to Tony Fells, just because I haven't talked to her in a while and I enjoy hearing from her. Is that you, Anne?
It is. How
How
are
are
you,
you?
Ian?
I'm doing so well. But so just so I understand, are you calling about the subject of the Salem witch trials?
I am.
Okay. Well, fascinating. Then hang for a second and I'll bring up Tony Fells with you in just a moment. I just want to make sure I understood what was going on. So thank you. Stand by for that. Dr. Anne Blake Tracy will be one of our callers for Tony Fells coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. All right, so Tony Fells is the author, the professor emeritus behind Switching Sides, about it's a review of the books, the most prominent books in the history of writing books about the history of the Salem witch trials, and how historians have been changing their view long in sort of a longitudinal study, looking at how they had at one point been much more sympathetic to the victims, and then that those allegiances had switched. But you know, along the way, I think you've heard there's some very compelling reasons to think we should be more sympathetic with the accusers, perhaps not all for the same reasons. On the first time caller line, though, Tony, is Dr. Anne Blake Tracy. She distinguishes herself as one of the first people to come out and talk openly about the SSRIs, the antidepressants, and their effect on some people that is in. Or she would argue, meant everybody, but that the SSRIs and the danger to society overall. So that's why I was surprised when I saw her on my screen about this subject. So I'll just leave it up to you. And where do you want to go with this?
Well, we probably never had a chance to talk about that section of my book, but I do talk about the Salem witch hunt because there is research, and I wondered if Tony was familiar with this. There's research that was done where they actually exhumed some of the bodies from the Salem witch hunt era and found evidence of ergot fungus in the stomach of those people, which would indicate that they were hallucinating or delusional. And I wondered if you were familiar with that, because the ergot fungus, of course, it's a base of LSD. And LSD and PCP both mimic serotonin to produce hallucinations. And now that we've got all these drugs out there that are increasing serotonin gradually, I tell everyone we're seeing the Salem witch hunts all over again.
Well, hang
I
on.
don't
Let's
know.
get. Thank you for that. Tony, have you
Yes,
heard about that?
I have. Yes, there was an article about ergot poisoning as a possible explanation for the hallucinations and the symptoms of possession among the accusers, because some of the strongest accusers were ones who had this the spectral evidence that I was talking about before, where they really believed that the specter or spirit of the suspect had come, you know, through the air and was choking them and attacking them and preventing them from speaking. And their symptoms were very pronounced. They'd be throwing themselves down on the ground. They'd be couldn't speak. Their tongues would be dramatically forced or seemingly forced up to the top of their mouths and so forth. So there was an article that spoke about that this possibly could be due to a fungus on, I believe, the rye plants or some of the grasses and edible grasses that grew in that area, and the fungus is called ergot. However, to my reading, this has not been well substantiated for a couple kind of pretty clear logical reasons. First of all, the ergot fungus grows just as well all up and down the east coast of North America. So It can be found in the what were the middle colonies of Pennsylvania, can be found in Virginia, and yet New England alone had witch hunting and witchcraft possession. The colonies to the south of the Puritans just almost didn't have it. I mean, occasionally, but very, very rarely. And the other factor that seems to discount this theory is that the hallucinations and symptoms of possession, the catatonia and so forth, were just started and stopped in the midst of an examination when the suspect would look at the person. And then if the people who were the accusers were having those fits that they were having, and then if they were sometimes touched by the suspect, the belief was that the possession would return to the suspect, and indeed their symptoms disappeared just immediately. So if you're suffering from a real external agent, like a fungus, it doesn't make sense that your symptoms would come and go so dramatically. Whereas if it was a social cause for a psychosomatic type illness or type of set of symptoms, then the setting really would make a difference. So I don't think very many practicing historians today give much credence to the ergot idea, but it is out there.
Let's go to Barbara in Carolina. Thank you so much, Dr. Tracy. It's good to hear your voice. Barbara in Carolina Beach, North Carolina, on Coast to Coast for Tony Fells. Barbara?
Hi, how are you?
Hello, good, thank you.
This isn't so much a switching sides perspective, but I'm wondering if any of the historians have approached this at all from a sexism perspective, since so many of the people that were targeted with these witch hunts were women.
I think you missed a section in there. Yeah, we did talk about that, but go ahead, Tony, explain to her that book. That'll be the one she'll want to read.
Yeah, the key book would be by Carol Carlson. It's K-A-R-L-S-E-N. It's called The Devil in the Shape of a Woman, and that's exactly what she argues, that it really was all about men persecuting women.
Now, we were talking about it earlier, Barbara. You may have missed it, but it's definitely and then his critique of that book is in his book, too. But that is such a strong point and should be never forgotten in this conversation, how disproportionate all of that was against the women. Let's go to Mike in Pasadena for Tony Ells on Fells on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Oh, hi. This is his friend Monique. His throat is hurting, so I'm taking over. We were listening to you talking about the occult and astrology, and not to get off topic here, but he was saying, well, occultist means hidden, and so many people, they take it as some sort of dark, demonic practice here. Same thing with astrology. It's hard to believe that energy work, light work can be lumped in with the negative stuff. So just wanted to know if Tony put anything positive in this book with regards to with the history of what? The history of the whole thing.
Right. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, exactly. I think there's lots of evidence that people were, even though it was shunned by the church and by the Puritans, there's lots of evidence that a number of people were interested in the occult, including astrology. They had guidebooks and manuals to practice it, and they were doing it, I would say, strictly for purposes that they thought of as good and helpful in terms of learning about the future that their lives might bring, or weather patterns, or all sorts of things of that sort. So I definitely think occult practices and astrology were present, and they were not done for negative or harmful purposes.
East of the Rockies, Melissa is in Hilton Head on Coast to Coast for Tony Fells. Go ahead, Melissa.
Hello, I have loved this, but one thing that I think is missing, because I feel like everybody's trying to make excuses for the people who did the harm to other people, and I call it righteousness versus self-righteousness. And self-righteousness allows people to put themselves above others and judge and make excuses, justification, rationalization to punish people that they want to control and that they don't want to influence other people. And in this modern world, we call it pathological narcissism, and that's a psychiatric term. It's very powerful. If you bring that into the conversation, people would learn a lot. But
I'm going to nuance something you said there, because I would use the definitions a little bit differently. I think righteousness is, you know, and we see this all the time in religious communities, righteousness is based on a belief of trying to restore and to use, you know, words and actions to make us better and to be more righteous in the context of whatever it is those beliefs are. And yet it's always important to remember righteousness is fleeting. It doesn't last. Just because you were righteous for a period of time, there's no guarantee you're going to be righteous an hour from now. You know, there's no halo effect that keeps you being righteous. But self-righteous, I think we were defining it differently, which would be that it's right because I thought it, is all that self-righteous really means. Because I think this, that means it's right. And so I think that's an interesting reflection in the context of the communities. I think in a lot of ways, perhaps some of the sympathies for the accusers was they were much more in the righteous category than the self-righteous. They weren't inventing this as they went along. They really were caught up in what they thought was a righteous thing to do for both, you know, to honor their tradition and also to preserve their community. But Tony, where are you on that?
I would simply add more ethical terminology than psychological. Again, it's ends justify the means. It's a kind of extremism of belief and a certainty rather than a humility about what you believe. So there's just such a strong sense that there's good and bad, and the community knows what the difference is, and we're going to purify our community by getting rid of the bad. That sort of extremism, certainty, lack of humility, all that contributes to ends justifying the means, I'd say.
Let's go to Trey, who's in Eugene, Oregon, on Coast to Coast for Tony Fells. Trey?
Hi. Welcome back, Ian. I'm so glad you're back.
Thank you.
I'm interested in karma. So I was wondering if there was any research or follow-up as to the futures or what happened to the people who were accusers.
Did they have consequences for those actions in a karmic way? Yeah.
Yes, and I actually do cover that in my book. I do list what is known about them. Not all the accusers, actually, I think just two or three, it's not known what happened to them. And there was maybe a core group of about 8 to 10, mostly late teenage women who were the accusers. In most cases, they showed trauma. But they did end up marrying and living kind of somewhat normal lives, but usually after about 10, 15 years. And they almost all left Salem. They moved to other communities where they later married, like in their middle 30s, which would be certainly late for that period of time.
Yeah.
But they did do that and have children and so forth. And in one of the most celebrated cases, it's not from Salem, but it's from an earlier case of witchcraft and possession, a case that occurred in Groton, Massachusetts in the 1670s that's been studied a lot and appears in a number of these books. In that case, the woman was in a very extreme state of catatonia and feeling bewitched and all of that, and then it just all subsided, and she married quite soon after these events happened and went on to have 6, 7, 8 children and, you know, really did seem to live a very normal life. So
did anything bad happen to anybody? who did all that crap?
Did anyone
suffer?
Tracy first mentioned karma in what she was saying. I don't know. Well, there's... There is actually a celebrated case in the lore of the Salem witch hunt, and I don't know how true this is, but one of the local ministers from Salem Town, a man named Nicholas Noyes, was one of the really strong witch hunters and endorsed what all the accusers were saying. And apparently, when one of the accused, named Sarah Good, was hanged, right before she was hanged, she was supposed to have said to Nicholas Noyes, you will drink blood, or, you know, you will be delivered of blood. And indeed, he died of a massive hemorrhage not Ooh. So long thereafter.
Dude.
But whether that's fully a true story or not, I couldn't say, but it is repeated in a lot of the books about Salem.
All right, wild card line. Joe is in Monterey, California, on Coast to Coast. Joe?
Thank you, Ian, for taking my call. Okay. What you're describing is they were all victims, number one. This is what you're describing is cult mind control. What happens is that there's a schism between their personality. They develop a cult identity and an authentic identity or personality. It's what is referred to as thought reform. So when they were threatened, they enter into the group consciousness, which is the cult identity. But during the day and whatever they did, they go into their authentic personality because they're outside that group mind. They were isolated, so there's no outside interference to give them reference points. This is happening today when we identify with the group. We lose our individuality. It's called a doctrine over individual. There's so many criteria that this actually fits all the 8 criteria that Litton developed.
Okay. Well, let's get Tony's thought on that. Tony, where are you with that?
Well, I think there seems to be a kernel of some truth to that, I think, because we're talking about a very religious community in the Puritans. Now, they didn't have a single leader like we sometimes associate with a cult. They weren't tiny. They were living in many villages and towns throughout Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire, Maine. So this is a big group of people in the tens of thousands by the end of the 17th century, maybe 75, 80,000. So in those respects, it's broader than what we think of as a little cult or most cults. But I do agree with you that group socialization is very powerful, and especially for people that all believe very strongly in a set of ideals, as the Puritans did, group identity certainly can take strong effects, both positive and negative. And I think in the Salem witch hunt, we're really seeing the negative effects.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out about the cult of personality that ordinarily we would associate that with a person or a small group of leaders, and that just wasn't the case in here. But it kind of speaks to a couple other things, though. Contagion theory, maybe, and the way in which ideas overtake and sort of, you know, skip across a larger, wider area that take hold temporarily, become fashionable, and then kind of, you know, die out. But okay, so that's where we'll have to put a pause on it for the moment. But Walt and Jason and Dean and Mary, other people, hang on. We'll get to you coming up. We're talking with Tony Fells, the author of Switching Sides. And it's a review of all of the most famous books that have been written, history books that have been written about the Salem witch trials, and to what degree they too maybe were bewitched by their own biases while they were recounting history. It's really a fascinating study. Along the way, we find out, I think, pretty accurately what the real story was or is, and we'll get you in on that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're gonna power through this last half hour. We'll get you an open line. You jump in for your questions for Tony Fells. Switching Sides. We're talking about the Salem witch trials, and boy, do we have a surprise guest for you, Tony Fells, on the phone next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So before he retired and became a professor emeritus, Tony Fells had spent many years researching and writing about the Salem witch trial, so he might enjoy a couple of things. I just got a tweet And it comes from the Salem Historical Tours people, Tony. And it says here that what Sarah Good said was, if you take my life away, God will give you blood to drink. Noise died and spit up blood. It was from a throat infection. Nevertheless, everyone felt that that was proof that Good was a witch. That's pretty much what she said, but I was just doubling that from the Salem Historical Tours. But I can do better than that. I've got Dean in Augusta, Maine, hanging on Coast to Coast AM, and Dean is east of the Rockies. And Dean, you're saying you have an ancestor who was hanged in Salem?
Yes.
Which one of your ancestors?
1692.
Who was that?
Rebecca Nurse. And she was 72 years old at the time, and they imprisoned her two sisters and pressed one of her sister's husbands to death, Miles Torrey, under rocks and boards. And the family had to sneak her down from the gallows in the middle of the night, putting their own lives at risk of being hung themselves. And it was a shame back then when you got accused of being a witch. And she even had 20 of her neighbors attest to her innocence, and they hung her anyway. And then conveniently after that, the governor got accused, his wife, of being a witch, and they quit believing in witchcraft after that.
Tony, you're talking to Dean.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And you know, I've had, I believe it's two students who are also descendants of Rebecca Nurse. So over the years, because I've taught the Salem Witch Hunt in my classes, my history classes. So I think there's a lot of descendants. It's a very big family. And I'm happy to hear, I mean, it's of course a very sad story, but I think it's really good to be reminded of these details about what happened to this 72-year-old woman who in no way, shape, or form was carrying out anything like witchcraft. And that's why, a big part of why I wrote the book, because these major studies that have come out in the last 40 years, they barely tell the story of Rebecca Nurse. Her name hardly appears. Whereas back in Marion Starkey's book, Devil in Massachusetts from 1949, a whole chapter was devoted to Rebecca Nurse. So this shows how something has changed among academic historians. They are just not interested in these heroines. And I think Rebecca Nurse was a real hero. She went to her death refusing to belie herself and admit to something that she had never done. And I think that is very heroic. It's well worth knowing about.
And Danvers is what used to be Salem, Danvers, Mass.
That's right.
Thank you, Dean. I appreciate that. While you're there, Mary is in Tucson, not too far away from where I'm sitting right now. And she, too, had an ancestor who was involved in the Salem witch trial. Mary?
Hello. Yes, we had a person who last name was Bradbury, and the reason that she wasn't put to death is because she came from Blue Blood.
She was on the Mayflower family.
Very interesting. After we found that out, and I've read in different books along the way about her, is that we have done our genealogy for that part of our family back to 733. And, of course, it proves to us that she did come from Blue Blood. Because if that was in the 1600s and we went back that far, it's very interesting that we have a witch. And then when you get into the Blue Bloods, there was a queen who became a saint. And so we've had a very interesting family.
Thank you, Mary. Tony?
Yes. Well, Mary Bradbury is well known, and apparently she was able to escape, and she evaded. I don't believe she was even tried, and as a result, she was not convicted. But there were a lot of people out to get her, and indeed she came from a well-to-do family north of Salem. I'm forgetting the name of the community up there, real close to New Hampshire.
Very good. Thank you, Mary. Appreciate that. Glad you jumped in. So that's so interesting that all of these you know, that this is still a viable connection. It's not that this is where history lives, is in that these are also family stories as well as, you know, historical accounts.
Very much so. You know, one of my neighbors on my street, once my book came out, I learned that he was a descendant of the Proctors, John and Elizabeth Proctor.
How about that? Well, let's go to Walt is in Pennsylvania, he's jumping in the conversation with Tony Fells, author of Switching Sides. Walt?
Hi, Ian. I guess I'm going to have to start referring to you as Dr. Punnett.
That's exactly right. But then we'd have to call him Dr. Fells, and we'd just be all doctoring each other. So let's not do that.
Dr. Fells, a great conversation. I just want to say that, you know, we're in a scientific age of space exploration and laser surgery, and but, you know, these old puritanical religious notions, they persist. I was telling Donna here in Pennsylvania, we have a sect, you've undoubtedly heard of them, called the Amish.
Yes.
They live in darkness. They believe that electricity and the internal combustion engines are the works of Satan. And down here in West Virginia, we have a sect where they dance with poisonous snakes because they believe in the Bible, which says that the believers shall not be fear the sting of the serpent, etc. Now, Ian, the case that I can't get my mind around is the case of the Fort Hood shooter. It's Dr. Nidal Hassan, who was a trained psychiatrist, and yet he allowed himself, how could a trained psychiatrist that's schooled in the pathologies of the human mind allow himself to be brainwashed into believing in the great Satan, et cetera? It just seemed inconceivable to me in this day and age.
Well, let's sort out a couple of things there, Walt, and I appreciate the kind words at the beginning. Remember, mental illness affects every community, and mental illness, which we often used to talk about in terms of possession or satanic, you know, invasion. I don't think of it in that way, but I understand your allusion to it. The doctor at Fort Hood, or any of the people who are accused of, you know, shooting up a building, a town, a church, any different than the kid that shot up the church basement in South Carolina. I think that mental illness, depression, schizophrenia, listening to voices, I don't think that any one religion holds, you know, a corner on that business. So I'm going to separate that out in terms of how he should have been able to respond to it if he was a trained psychologist. Know too that psychologists are also human beings, and for all he knew, he wasn't crazy. And that's really when we know people really are, I think, is the ones who don't think they are. And it let's just separate that out. In terms of like the Amish, I don't think it's not that they think that the devil is in machinery or electricity. It's just it's an interesting, you know, connection to Puritanism, because the Amish didn't feel like the Puritans went far enough, and they were much more resistant to modernity, is really all that it was. And they continue to be resistant to modernity because they want to practice a very simple faith. So I don't know that they find that the devil's in electricity. What they see is the devil is perhaps in greater society. And in order to have electricity, you have to run a wire, and that wire connects you to the community, which is where they don't want to be. So, I mean, I just happened to write an article that's going to be in a book later on this year about the Amish and the internet. And lots of Amish people are on the internet. And there's Amish people that carry cell phones because it's disconnected. They don't have to be connected to a grid in order to be able to use a cell phone. So I just throwing that in there so we don't put everybody in the same category. The snake handlers, I can't even begin to explain that. So let's just leave that there and say, yes, fundamentalism and religious conditioning still exist. Where do you think that religious conditioning was most prevalent in Salem? Tony?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. I mean, the community was filled with people who were devoted to their religious ideals, and There were ministers that were, you know, important leaders of each congregation, and there were the leading full members of each congregation who had testified to a profound conversion experience and so forth. So I think of it as very widespread. Until it changed, and it did change. After all, New England becomes also the center of Unitarianism,
right,
100 years later, and liberal Congregationalism, and today the United Church of Christ, one of the most liberal Protestant denominations, is the direct lineal descendant of the Puritans.
This should be pointed out too, I think, to some degree, is that there was even a dispute, we didn't really touch on it at the time, between the two factions in Salem, one which was more progressive than the other. One was willing, just like we were talking about with the Amish, one was beginning to think differently about some of the tenets of the original Puritan.
That church was strong in Salem town, and they had adopted what was called the Halfway Covenant, which had been adopted by something like 80% of the Massachusetts churches, which allowed the children of congregation members who had not, that if a member had not testified to a full conversion experience, which was very strenuous and difficult, and a lot of people didn't want to pretend to have had that if they didn't, well, now their children could be baptized. And that was a step in the direction of opening up these churches to somewhat less strenuous form of faith and just embracing everybody. So the Salem Village Church was unusual. It was particularly conservative. It was holding to the very original view that the only full members of the church would be ones who could really testify to a profound conversion experience in front of the whole group. So they were on the conservative side, and I think that does help explain why the witch hunt probably began in a congregation of that sort.
And why when the Amish would go by in their horse and buggy, they'd look at that church and they'd go, liberals! Jason is in Nevada on Coast to Coast for Tony Fels. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much, Ian. I really appreciated the comments you just made, by the way, about the whole complexity of this issue that we're speaking about. And it seems to get so convoluted once you sort of look at every single facet of every possibility of what could be going on here. And that was mainly what I called on about originally, was just to ask, because I felt it was a bit dismissive to not really look at the fact that women typically were the ones who would be more knowledgeable at plants and herbs and using these types of things in medicinal ways. And there are numerous medicinal herbs which are based in belladonna alkaloids. And anybody who, researches any of this, we must look and examine how much of a crossover there is in all of this of about just women using traditional herbs and herbology and things from even the old world that carried across into the new world. And especially about the prevalence of plants that existed around that area, specifically the Jimson weed, which I've seen growing up there when I went over. I visited up into those areas up in the Northeast, and it just grows wild everywhere. And it's an extremely beneficial herb for anybody who knows herbology or anything like that to use in so many situations. Yet at the same time, simultaneously, it can induce one of the most intense hallucinogenic and truly hallucinogenic and delirium type of states, where if you just went a little too far with it, using it for something else it's beneficial for, which the uses are innumerable. They still use it in emergency rooms, some of the alkaloids in individually, and even scopolamine, which is Dramamine, which they give for motion sickness when you're on a boat and things like this.
Sure.
So what I think is that we have to look at every single facet of everything that could possibly be going into this situation, and to see that it's probably a really fuzzy picture we're going to get of all the things that played into how all of this happened, and that definitely it had to have something to do with altered states and herbology. And I wanted to know if you think that's
possible. Tony, what do you think?
Well, I don't have too much to add to the previous caller who had spoken about ergot, that fungus, as a possible herbal agent that induce these hallucinations and contortions. I guess I don't think one needs to have that as an explanation. I think psychosomatic illness makes sense if you really fear that your soul could be lost forever to the devil, and that you could be consigned to hell in an afterlife. That would be reason enough. And also, everybody knew what the symptoms of bewitchment were. They were kind of stereotyped in certain ways, which included, you know, that you couldn't speak and your tongue would go up to the top of your mouth, and you would be catatonic for a state, and you would hallucinate in a certain way and imagine these specters coming to poke you and choke you and so forth. And that was exactly the form that these symptoms took. So to me, it seems more cultural and social rather than medicinal.
But it's interesting he talks about, and it, I think, I don't know what exists, but it has always been a case of women being the ones that knew most about the herbs and local remedies and homeopathic solutions. A professor I once had once told me that that a lot of women would have been accused of witchcraft in Europe who were really would have just been trying to be doctors. They were just trying to, right? But that was that line between that people couldn't always figure out. And that the bottom line for every, what did he say? Like the bottom line for every old wives' tale was that women were the ones that knew how to get the babies to go to sleep at night. And I always thought that was such an interesting way of looking at it. It's the same struggle we might all have, but it can lead to so many different things. We're out of time. I wish I could have gotten everybody on and so many interesting things. For example, Jeff was related to Catherine Hewitt, burned at the stake in 1492, and Ryan was asking about warlocks. But that is the way it goes sometimes. We get caught up, and next thing you know, we look up at the clock, and we're hearing panpipes. So let me say thank you so much, Tony, for your attitude and for the way you shared the stuff and how flexible you were and the way in which you could really get down to the truth of Salem and the way in which it's been written about all these years. You were a great guest.
Very much.
Thank you. And to everybody else, sorry if I couldn't get you on, but, you know, I'll be back again in a month or so, whenever they need me. I told them a long time ago, put me in, coach. I don't smoke. I'm ready to play whenever you need me to touch the ball. So who knows, sometime in August. In the meantime, Deus te amat, and I do too.